This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Hi, I'm here with Paul Denton from the British Geological Survey. Welcome to the Jodcast.
Thanks very much.
And what are you doing here at the festival?
So we've got an activity based on earthquakes and seismology. So we're trying to demonstrate some of the principles of tectonic activity on a world map. Mm-hmm. And also show something about how we measure earthquakes and how earthquake waves travel through the Earth.
How do earthquake waves travel through the Earth?
Well, there's two different types of waves. There's primary waves and secondary waves, which physicists call longitudinal and transverse waves. At the festival here, we're demonstrating those with slinkies. So we've got kids making waves go up and down slinkies.
And do those two waves travel through the Earth in the same way, or do they travel differently?
Well, I mean, one of the reasons seismologists are so interested in those types of waves is precisely because they have different properties. So the P waves travel faster, and because they're longitudinal waves, they can also travel through solids and liquids, whereas the secondary waves, the S waves, are transverse waves, and they can only travel through solids. So that's one of the reasons that we know that the core of the Earth is a liquid, because of monitoring how these different types of waves travel through the Earth.
I never knew that at all. So you said that the P waves and S waves can't both travel through liquids, but I know in the ocean it's a combination of longitudinal transverse waves creates the... I'm making hand signals, which is not helpful on a podcast, but that's what gives you kind of the wave type structure on the top. So why is that different?
Well, the ocean waves only exist at a free surface. So they only exist in the top few hundred metres of the ocean. We actually get similar types of waves on the Earth, in the solid Earth, where we get that type of surface wave that just travels around the surface of the Earth, and it's the same type of motion. It's a retrograde elliptical particle motion, but it only exists in the top few wavelengths of the Earth, and it's the interface between the free surface and the solid Earth.
I had no idea you got those kind of waves on the Earth. That's incredible. Okay. And so what does studying these waves help to tell you now? So you said that originally provided evidence for the liquid core, but what else are you trying to learn from them now?
Well, nowadays, because we've got so many sensors distributed all over the world, we can do tomographic studies, so we can actually map the internal structure of the Earth in three dimensions by seeing how these waves propagate through the Earth. I mean, it's the same maths as medical tomography. And we're just using earthquakes as energy sources, and then thousands of receivers distributed around the world as detectors.
Oh, okay, that's fascinating. So you have this, you're constructing like a 3D model of the Earth. Well, the Earth is 3D, but yeah, a 3D model of the Earth. And so by studying earthquakes, you can learn more about the Earth, but also does studying those help you to understand future earthquakes and that kind of thing as well?
Well, I mean, we can by measuring earthquakes that have happened in the past, we can build statistical models of how likely earthquakes are to happen in different places in the future, which is very useful for when you're designing a building code or trying to design buildings that will withstand the most likely amount of shaking. But the other thing that scientists are doing now is that we can't predict earthquakes, but we can do what we call early warning. So if we measure an earthquake as it happens, because the shaking waves take a finite amount of time to reach their destination, if we can get a message that an earthquake has happened, it can give us 10 or 20 seconds warning that severe shaking is about to happen. It doesn't sound like very long, but if you tie that into an automatic monitoring system. So in Japan at the moment it's tied to the bullet trains. So they automatically slow down if an earthquake has happened and they know that the shaking is going to disrupt the tracks in front of it.
That's amazing. Like, sorry, that's just blowing my mind. That's like the future is now.
Yeah. I mean, they're trying to do it in America as well. They've got the sensors set up in California. They just need to get some funding from the federal government to actually roll that out as a statewide early warning system.
Oh, fantastic. And I know it's one of the other things you've got on your stand is this huge world map showing all the fault lines and so on. And I have a quick question about them, and I want to go into them. There's some really, really tiny plates on there that are, like, so you've got the, you know, the big Eurasian plate, but there's really tiny ones that look like the size of a small country. Why are they so small?
I mean, it's the classic problem in the whole of science. If you look at the big picture, it looks quite simple.
Yeah.
But as soon as you start looking at the details around the edges, things get more complicated. And it's almost a fractal problem in that the closer you look, the more complicated it becomes. So as soon as you start looking at particularly where two or three plates meet in a triple junction, it just becomes really, really complicated. So studying these microplates and how they're moving, you know, it's an ongoing area of research for a lot of scientists.
So we're still not exactly sure where these microplates, as you call them, like how they use the force.
Well, I mean, the whole idea of a plate as a rigid block that moves as a single entity is a simplification. So obviously there are deformations that are happening within plates, and in some cases it's actually more effective to model what's happening as a plate deforming rather than as interactions happening at the edges of plates.
Oh, I never knew that. Yeah, because I think I have this very simplistic image in my head of like plates floating on something. So it's of course it is more complicated. Yeah, everything always is.
No, I mean it's, and nowadays we've got the tools with satellite imagery. We can do radar interferometry to measure displacements after earthquakes. We can use super accurate GPS to actually measure plate motions in real time. So we're able to generate a huge amount of data, and then the challenge is to try and understand that data. I mean, it's the same in all sciences.
Yeah, that makes sense. So one last question. You said you do quite a bit of outreach in this area. If there is one, what would you say is the biggest misconception people tend to have when it comes to geology or seismology that you would like to iron out?
Well, I mean, one of the things that we quite often come up against is when people think about the structure of the Earth, they have the crust, the mantle and the core, and they know that the crust is solid, and they know that the core is liquid. But a lot of people think that the mantle is liquid as well because of models that they've seen of convection happening in the mantle. Whereas from a scientific point of view, the mantle is solid because it's capable of supporting shear waves, the S waves, the transverse waves, which can only occur if a material's got sufficient shear strength to support them. So we try and get away from that misconception that plates are floating on top of a runny mantle. It's not really like that. The mantle is, if you had a piece of it in your hand, it would look like a very hot piece of rock. It's not a liquid.
I completely did think of it as a runny liquid, but that makes sense. And is it because people see, you're saying that convection occurs and people can't, it's hard to imagine that happening for a solid,
it's a problem with timescales. So if you're thinking about timescales of millions of years, then there is convection within that solid mantle. But if you think of it on timescales of, you know, years or hours or minutes, it's very much a solid. So we use silly putty as an analogy. So silly putty, if you leave it alone, it will kind of ooze and flow. But I don't know if you've ever tried this experiment, but if you hit a piece of silly putty with a hammer, it actually shatters into a million pieces. So in the same way, the mantle on the timescales of human beings is a solid. It's only when you stretch that timescale out to millions of years that it starts to flow and we can support these convection cells.
That makes sense. I've learned something new. That's fantastic. Well, thank you for speaking to us on the Jodcast.
Thank you very much.
And I hope you enjoy the rest of the weekend. Okay.